This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with composer Rich Douglas. Hey, it's great to have a chance to talk with you.
It's great to be on the show.
Your symphony, Another World, is just an amazing project. And it, I think, really speaks to just what an incredible game this is, because Another World has been chosen by MoMA as part of their permanent collection of really groundbreaking games. And it's just amazing. And I know that you've been playing it ever since it was released, ever since you were young. And so what is it about the game that really, like, speaks to you?
The art style, first and foremost.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, and it's interesting mentioning the art style, because I feel like I feel strongly in the indie scene today in 2017, that game could hold up and hold its own. Like, it's the art style is so cool because it's minimalist, but it really puts you in that world with Lester, the main character, and it's just really cool. And that's what dragged me in as a kid when I saw it. And of course, when I was younger, it was really frustrating to play. But the graphics were the main reason that I got pulled to that game as a younger gamer.
Yeah, I was astonished to learn that the creator of the game actually wrote his own engine so that he could make the game.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's also surprising is that with the updates to the game, there were a few iterations for, like, different ports. And so the music wasn't the same from one version to another.
That's correct. In fact, the composer's favorite version, the most complete version, is the Sega CD version, which is what this release kind of, I guess, revolves around. Because the themes, he had three or four motifs that were carried through the Genesis version, the Super Nintendo version, but everyone kind of that's familiar with the game considers the Sega CD version to be the definitive release of the soundtrack. And so that's what I decided to take and do basically a note-for-note official licensed release of, because that's kind of what the composer had in mind when he was writing the music for the game.
That's so cool. I mean, it's kind of like going back and, I don't know, restoring Beethoven or something.
Exactly. I mean, because at the time he was using a bunch of synthesizers and all that stuff, because that was kind of the thing back then as well, before sampling was a deal. And so, yeah, it was kind of like going back and recreating something from scratch. It's just a heck of an experience.
I can imagine. And I mean, besides your love of the game, what was the real sort of spark that got you thinking that you could write a symphony from all of this music in the game?
I like to play the game at least once or twice a year, and I booted up the Sega CD version, and I really started to take notice to the music. For some reason, it hadn't really set in the past. And so I noticed this time around that, hey, there's some pretty cool themes in here, and there's some really interesting textural stuff, and the game's got a popular fan base. This could be fun to kind of go through and do some sort of reorchestration of what the original composer had done. And so that was the original spark. It's just hearing it, being inspired by it, and wanting to pursue the symphony.
Yeah, it's really amazing. It's been fun to listen to the original version and then your orchestrated version as kind of an A-B thing to kind of work out what you did with the palette. And many, many composers that I talk with, and maybe this is true for you too, they sort of start a project by picking out a palette, because, you know, with samples and synth sounds, you've basically got billions of colors. And
Oh, yes.
So how did you work out what the palette was going to be for this orchestral version?
That is actually a little more simpler than you would think, because what I wanted to do was I really wanted to represent the otherworldly aspect. And a lot of people would have taken that and done that with synthesizers, which is great. It would have been really cool. There's a lot of cool things you can do with analog gear. And there's plenty of analog synths woven throughout. But what I wanted to do was up the tension level and up the, you know, I mean, you got to think about poor Lester getting transported to this crazy world with all these, you know, crazy beasts and stuff trying to get him. And it seems like everything's trying to kill him around every corner.
So even the rocks.
I wanted the music to represent that. And so I kind of relied more on weird, really tense textural string work. And I feel like that kind of represents the harshness of the environment. Thank you.
Yeah, and there's this kind of open sound that you got that I think really sort of reinforces the loneliness of the game. Because Lester, he does have kind of a friend, one of the prisoners, but mm-hmm. even that's sort of ambiguous because that guy looks like all the others. And so you don't really know who your friends are. And so that openness, I think, really kind of reinforces what a lonely game this is to play.
Oh, totally, totally. And that's loneliness. That is definitely the epitome of the album, I think. That kind of summarizes what the vibe is and what I was going for. I just really think that he's kind of trying to survive on his own, and that's what I wanted this iteration of the music to represent.
Yeah, and there are some moments, well, like Escape, that, you know, talk about tension. You've like really ramped it up in that track, and maybe you could like break it down and talk about how you came to the final version of that one.
Basically, I took, you'll hear the motifs are very similar. They're not completely note for note, especially the percussion stuff. I wanted to kind of put my own twist on it. And I do that with all my licensed re-releases and reorchestrations. I kind of put my own signature on it to make it unique. But I wanted to propel the piece forward while retaining, like, there's that very first opening motif, and that runs throughout the entire score. But I wanted to retain that because that was Jean-Francois' signature, and I didn't want to lose that. But the rest of the tension mainly came from, you'll hear a lot of like stopwatch ticking, lots of subtle stuff like that, sticks clacking, and I wanted that time aspect to be in there. You know, I mean, the clock is ticking, get out of here, that kind of thing.
And it works really, really well. I mean, even just listening to it, you know, away from the game, it really captures that tension. And the brief respite is also such a great antidote for that.
I'm glad you like that one. We'll be right back. Yeah, that actually, I think that's one of my favorites. That and Flight. I like Flight a lot just because of the beauty of it. It's kind of a release at the end of the album. There's all this tension, tension, tension. And then it's just kind of this beautiful piece of that motif that I mentioned earlier. There it is again. And it kind of ends the album on a on more of an uplifting note, even though the ending of the game is not very uplifting.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ambiguous, really. I mean, where do they go? That pterodactyl.
Exactly. We just don't know. I mean, they hopefully they have escaped, but we may never know. Evidently, the sequel, which wasn't really a true sequel, Heart of the Alien, that they kind of rejected that. Like that, it was made, it was produced, but I don't really think that the creator had that in mind as far as the sequel. At least that's what he said in interviews that I've read. So yeah, who knows where they end up.
They had an interesting way of working, it sounds like, because the composer, Jean-Francois, didn't actually get to see a lot of the game as it was being developed. Apparently, Eric Shahi didn't really share a lot of concept art and, you know, the way games are made now where they're a little bit rough in the beginning. He didn't share that with Jean-Francois, which I think gave Jean-Francois a bit of a disadvantage because he didn't have the longer period of time or the various iterations to kind of work out what his music was going to be like.
Right. And that's it's interesting you bring that up because the only other musician or group in this case that works like that when they're scoring something, to my knowledge, is Tangerine Dream. Like when they scored all their stuff in the 80s, like Risky Business or Thief or any of that, to my knowledge, they didn't really score to picture, and it was very much similar with this. Like he was given, the composer was given a generic outline of the story and then just started making music, and that music was plopped in the game where appropriate, which I thought was very interesting because that just wouldn't fly with game scoring these days.
Yeah, and it's just a miracle that it works as well as it does.
It's true.
And the other thing that it really incorporates, Jean-Francois' music, and maybe you can speak to this as a sound designer too, is how it really plays so well with the sound design of the game. And it sounds like in your symphonies, you've also kind of incorporated some sound design aspects.
Yeah. There's quite a bit of subtle sound design going on Another World, the second track of the album. For example, there's this kind of otherworldly wind that I kind of worked in to very, very low. It's mixed very low, but there's subtle stuff like that I wanted to use throughout the score. So yeah, there's definitely a sound design aspect. I'm also a sound designer by trade, so it was kind of fun to commingle those aspects into this album.
Yeah, and it really gives it a kind of a, I don't know, a 3D effect, I guess, more than just the music would have had on its own, which is really cool. Now, the symphony is available on your Bandcamp site. Anywhere else a person could pick it up?
Yeah, absolutely. iTunes, Amazon. I believe it's on Google Play. It's pretty much anywhere digital albums are sold. And since it's officially licensed, we were able to do that. And it's the first time, actually, that I was able to put it on my Bandcamp page. And that's thanks largely to the Materia Collective, the group that had published it. I've worked with them for years, ever since they were founded. And they're just a great group and a very talented group of musicians. But without them, the Bandcamp aspect would not have happened.
Yeah, that is very cool. And let's talk a little bit about Materia Collective, because they have just grown by leaps and bounds, you know, from their beginnings with covers of Final Fantasy music, and now there are artists from all over the world and composers putting original soundtracks up there too. So you mentioned that you've been involved with them for a long time. So what kind of support do they provide?
They provide any sort of licensing support, artwork support. They can work with you on that. They will blast out press releases, which was extremely helpful, because before I was doing that all myself. And since I'm a full-time composer, it's tough to find the time to do a lot of that biz dev aspect to this. And especially for albums like the symphony album, that's from the heart, and it's just kind of like a fun side project. It's not like a full-time kind of thing, but they'll provide any sort of services that any other composers may be needing as far as licensing or press releases or anything like that is concerned. And they're really quick, and they're really, really easy to work with, which is awesome.
Oh, that is so cool. Do you have plans at all to create a version of this that a live orchestra could play?
I don't at this time, but I wouldn't say that's out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I mean, because video game concerts seem to be like really a growing thing. And it seems like there's like more and more demand for them. So,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That could be a lot of fun, actually, now that you mention it.
Yeah, I'd go.
Nice.
Well, it was just backing up a little bit. I'm curious about what got you into composing music for games in the first place.
Ooh, that's a long story. I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. It's weird because I'm not similar to a lot of my fellow composers, because I've never been classically trained. I play everything by ear. And it's interesting because I started writing music when I was in film school at Montana State back in 2001. It was actually a dare. I'd been collecting film scores for about 15 years up until that point. And my roommate at the time, he dared me to help him score a student film. And so I went down to the local music shop in Bozeman and picked up a synthesizer, an Alesis QS61, and learned how to use some basic recording software on my PC, and found I kind of had an ear for it randomly. It was the most bizarre thing. I was like, wow, I can make the kind of music that I like to listen to. This is really cool. And so from there, I ended up at the Guildhall at SMU. I was the second cohort to go through that back in 2003. And while I was there, I ended up doing music and sound for like 80% of the student projects. And it's really interesting because not only did I come out of that program with a slew of really good friends who I still talk to this day, but also a couple of people that I work with on a regular basis now, which is really cool.
Wow, yeah. Well, that must have given you a really great training in writing all different genres of music, because I'm sure everybody had, you know, different ideas for their projects.
Oh, sure.
Too. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that was exactly right. They, you know, one day it would be a medieval game. The next day it was a horror game taking place in a creepy old house. And at the time, I didn't really, you know, just between you and I didn't really know what the heck I was saying. I was just kind of flailing around, and I was able to get my hands on some decent sample libraries, and I could act like I could walk the walk, and I think that was part of the reason this all worked out, because now all these composers, up-and-coming composers, the market is very saturated because everybody has access to these awesome tool sets, and so it's tough to set yourself outside of what everybody else is doing. And so that was just kind of a different time. But yeah, kind of flailing around a little bit there, I'm not going to lie.
But I think that's what happens with a lot of people. They don't necessarily intend to become composers for games, and yet they just sort of drop into it because the opportunity presents itself. And so
Oh, that's true. That's
Yeah.
true. I actually started out as a level designer at id Software,
Oh,
and so
wow.
I kind of sidestepped into it, and it was something I wanted to pursue, but and that's the biggest piece of advice I always give people that come to me via email or whatever, wanting to know how to break into this industry is I always advise them to take a roundabout way of doing it, and I always advise learn code, learn how to do art, learn how to do level design, anything. It just adds value, and it also kind of gets you in the door a roundabout way, and then you can be like, hey, I compose music. Would you like to try this in the game? And that's kind of how it worked at id for me,
Yeah.
and so it just kind of warped into what it is today.
That's so cool. And you've done a lot of projects. I mean, you've been busy like all the way straight through, which is fantastic. And are there any projects of yours that like really stand out that you're especially proud of?
Shadowgate.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely Shadowgate. And that was a very special project for me because I was contacted by Dave Marsh of Zojoy, and he's just amazing. In fact, I'm working with him on something really cool. I can't talk about it, But those guys were the original developers on the NES version of the game back in 87, and they had the rights to all the chiptune music, and so I could reorchestrate all of that stuff, and it was just surreal, because that I grew up playing that game as a kid. I loved that game, and it was just really cool to be able to use Mizuno-san's themes and motifs. The other really cool thing was the year after it was released in 2015, I was at GDC and I ran into Mizuno, the original composer, and we kind of stopped and looked at each other. He goes, "Oh my, you're the guy who did the music for the remake." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is Hiroyuki Mizuno right in front of me. You're the guy that inspired me. This is great." And so we sat down and chatted for about 30 minutes, and he's just a super nice and sweet guy. But yeah, that project really sticks out as one of my personal favorites. That and Lifeless Planet is the other one. And I just started scoring Lifeless Moon, the sequel, which is due out next year. But both of those are very, very dear to me. And I think part of that is because both of them happened right when my career was kind of starting to take off, as it were. And so those are my first two large projects that people kind of associate with me as a composer.
That's so cool. And it's really wonderful that you get a chance to work on projects that are like really dear to your heart too, rather than just, I don't know, being a composer for hire, which isn't a bad thing, but sometimes if you're not really feeling it, it makes it harder to come up with something really special.
So. It is. And there, you know, honestly, there are projects like that where I do them and I enjoy, you know, look, I enjoy everything that I do, but I'd be lying if I was like, oh man, all these projects are the greatest thing ever. And I think that's, again, something else that people that want to break into this, they think that everything's just going to be super awesome and everything is going to be great. I'm going to be sitting here and composing music day in and day out and I won't have to deal with difficult people. And that's just not true.
Game design. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like any other business. And there are people that have ideas that you kind of don't understand, but you just sort of have
to. And then, you know, you start, you just have to ask a lot of questions and be patient. And that's the most important thing. So, yeah. It's, you know, it's always interesting. And I like it because you never know what's going to happen next. You never know what somebody's going to contact you to want music or sound for. It's really cool.
That would be really cool. And I'd love to find out just a little bit about your work on the Stranger Things game, too, because that was like a really under the radar thing. Nobody knew that it was in development. And I love the way it looks. It looks like a game from the 80s and it's got that kind of chippy synth soundtrack.
Right, right. Yeah, this whole 8-bit Super Nintendo Sega Master System thing. And that was a real interesting project, actually. It was put out by a team called Bonus XP. And those guys are just a great group of guys. And Dave Pottinger, the lead over there, called me up months and months ago. And at the time, I was working with them on another project that's called Hero Academy 2. It's due out soon. And I'm doing all the sound and most of the music on that thing. But anyway, they contacted me, and he's like, I've got this super secret project. You can't tell anybody about it. You know, it's Stranger Things. I pretty much lost myself on the phone. I was like, you're kidding me. There may have been a few four-letter words, you know. I mean, it was like I was just through the roof excited about this. And, you know, then they mentioned it was an 8-bit game. And admittedly, I got a little terrified because chiptune stuff is not necessarily something that I do on a day-to-day basis. Same with the sound for it. I did all the music and sound. And it was terrifying at first, but then we started going and we started talking about where the music should go and what it should sound like and what the sound should sound like. And once I got on a roll, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to sort of go back in time and do something like that. But it turned out so well. Like I play it myself. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, playing games in the 80s too. And everything about it is just like spot on and pitch perfect. So you guys really nailed
cool.
it.
It's well, really I'm glad cool. to hear that, Kate. Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, it was surreal. I was on a plane coming back from Montana, I guess, you know, a month ago. And I got up to go grab a bottle of water at the other end of the plane and was walking back. I saw no less than like 5 or 6 people playing that game on the plane. And I was just, you know, it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild when you hit that point in your career where you know people are seeing your stuff and hearing your stuff. And you just kind of forget about that sometimes. And it was just cool to see that.
Oh, really, yeah. Yeah. So did you like nudge them and say, that's my game? Or
No, but I may have been giggling a little bit as I walked by, and then when I got back to where my wife and kid were sitting, I just kind of was like, oh my gosh, you're not going to believe this. I saw all these people playing this game. It's kind of surreal.
Yeah, it is, especially because you work in this bubble, and until the game is out there, you really have no idea what kind of impact it's going to have or whether people are going to like it or play it.
It's true. It's true. A bubble. That is the best way to describe it. You can know everything about the game. You can be on board day one, and then you still just don't know, A, how it's going to do and be received, and B, where it's going to go. You know, it's pretty wild. Pretty wild.
You've mentioned that, you know, this is your full-time gig. So how do you balance the various projects as they come along? I mean, do you have to like stack them up and work on them on different days, or how do you sort of keep them all separate?
Lots of whiskey. No, I'm kidding. no, yes, various days. It wasn't so hard about 2 or 3 years ago when I was having to deal with I was wrangling one project at a time, and it was, man, I miss those days. It was so much easier. But now, yeah, I'll get on the phone with the team. Like, for example, the Hero Academy guys, bonus guys, I'll get on a call with them usually on Mondays, and I'll work for them. My office hours for them are Monday and Tuesday. And then for Dave Marsh, you know, I'll fit him in pretty much whenever. We've become really good friends. And so, I'm kind of working on his game nonstop, just off and on, as it's something I'm very excited about, and it's just really cool. And the other guys, you know, I just kind of have to schedule in advance and get everything kind of rocking and rolling, get my ducks in a row, and kind of keep as organized as possible. Because the second you lose that organization, that's when the stress starts to hit, and that's no good.
Yeah, I find that too with my job with the studio. If I don't have my CDs lined up, all of a sudden it's like, yeah, the stress level just sort of ramps up. But do you find that it's a challenge not living in LA or some other hub of game developers, like maybe Seattle?
Well, yes and no. I think that you know, I've made it work by basically being in Texas my entire life, and so that's not to say that going to LA wouldn't have sped things up or kind of changed my direction, which I think that, you know, if there's anybody listening that wants to do this full time, I say get out there to LA and do it and just embed yourself in that culture.
Well, is there anything else? You mentioned that you're working on a secret project. Anything else you can share about projects that are coming up?
I can talk a little bit about Lifeless Moon if you'd like
sure.
to know about
that. Sure, yeah, for sure.
Well, that is the sequel to Lifeless Planet by Stage 2 and David Board. And Dave Board is just a real nice guy. And I was so glad when he tapped me to come back and kind of bring my sound to Lifeless Moon. And so from there, I used a whole bunch of canned sample library stuff on the first one because the budget just wasn't there for live musicians. But on this one, it's very exciting. I kind of linked up with a fellow Materia Collective cellist named Andrew Dunn. And so he has provided me with just a boatload of awesome cello work that's going to be woven throughout the score at various stages. And I've also been creating a whole bunch of synth patches from the ground up. So everything's going to be very original sounding for this thing. It's going to be awesome. I am so excited to like really start diving in soon.
Oh, man, that sounds fantastic. And it just sort of points out that it doesn't take much. It doesn't take a whole raft of live musicians to bring a whole soundtrack to life.
You know, that's an interesting stipulation because Hans Zimmer even said recently that it doesn't matter even if you take like a rubber band and put it around like a tic-tac box and pluck it. It's a live instrument. And I feel very strongly about that. I think that because there's a lot of people that believe you have to have a 90-piece orchestra, blah, 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 in order for it to be credible and to sound cool. And that's just not true. You know, it's amazing what you can do with literally a synth and a cello.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I can't wait to hear it. That sounds awesome. And Rich, thanks so much for spending some time. You've really got some amazing projects going on. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about them.
Well, it was my pleasure, Kate. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show.